Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokane7.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, full-time law professor at Gonzaga University School of Law.
And I'm Nathan Weinbender, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio.
And welcome to Movies 101, the show that tries its best to live out our own version of the truth, even if we three tend to stick each to our own personal perspectives. Anyway, truth is at the heart of at least two of the films, both documentaries we'll be discussing this week. One is Enemies of the State, while the other is Misha and the Wolves. We'll end by honoring the memory of the late Rolling Stones drummer Charlie Watts by remembering Martin Scorsese's 2008 concert film, Shine a Light. Let's begin this week's show by looking at a story that involves either government conspiracy or clear criminal activity, or maybe even both. In the early 1990s, the Japanese company Tenyo put out a book of what is known as autostereograms, which simply explained are 2D illustrations that mask 3D images. Based on the work of the neuroscientist Christopher Tyler, autostereograms became immediately popular, even if some of us, try as we might, could never quite see the hidden images. Those images come to mind when considering the documentary film Enemies of the State, directed by Sonia Kennebec, because the film begins by offering one particular view of a situation before, slowly but gradually, shifting to something else completely. In short, Kennebec focuses on the DeHart family, a trio of Americans, father Paul, mother Leanne, and son Matt, who go afoul of the legal system when son Matt claims to possess damningly classified national documents, and who, in return, is accused by the government of harboring child pornography. Shifting in its perspective, Enemies of the State is an intriguing exploration of presumed guilt, professed innocence, and cinematic storytelling that plays fast and loose with its search for a sense of actual truth.
I'm glad you mentioned the structure of this film, Enemies of the State, because that's what I wanted to focus on myself. Because I think for some people, the structure is going to work, and for others, it won't. And I was more on the won't side of things, even though I don't think this is a bad film by any means. I was sort of frustrated by the way it was put together. And this is why. It begins by just sort of pummeling us with facts and timelines about people that we don't even know yet. So we're like already kind of like, whoa, right when this movie starts. And then it moves things around in a way to obfuscate, I guess, for lack of a better term, a twist that comes at the end of the movie. And so the timeline is deliberately juggled in order to keep that piece of information from us. And I understand why the filmmaker would want to do that, because it is sort of a damning gotcha moment in the last 20 minutes or so of this film. But it made things very confusing. And I don't know about you guys, but that was my experience of watching Enemies of the State, is I almost felt like I needed to start putting together a family tree of sorts. So I was like, okay, this person's related to this person, and this person had this kind of info. It's almost needlessly confusing. And yet I think that's what the movie is basically about. And this filmmaker, Sonia Kennebec, has made other films about government whistleblowers and government secrets and the consequences of knowing such things. And so she's clearly fascinated by those topics, and so willfully holds out on us in order to make this broader statement about the nature of truth and the nature of corruption and what it actually means to be a whistleblower. And can a person who's potentially not a good person be a whistleblower? And trying to weed out the worst instincts of the government. Can those two things be mutually exclusive? So I thought that was interesting. And we're going to be talking more about identity and how that relates to interview subjects and documentaries later in the show, I suspect. But yeah, I found this compelling because I was curious to see how it played out. And yet I thought that the way it was put together made it almost convoluted in a way that it didn't need to be. It's also possible that I am just dumb and and this movie was too smart for me and I didn't understand it. But I could not pass a test on the details of this case.
Right. But I don't think that that's your problem, because it's the same problem that MP and I had both with this movie and with the movie Misha and the Wolves, which we'll talk about later. There's this growing genre of these kinds of documentaries in which they present a case and then undercut that case intentionally, so that you don't know what the truth is And it's a weird way of trying to get at a truth without getting into any kind of truth at all. And it's right. also complicated. It's also complicated by these use of reenactments. You know, it was really Errol Morris who popularized the use of reenactments. And he was really criticized at the very beginning before he finally won his own Oscar for that. But now they're putting reenactments in these movies without really telling us. So you have to guess, is that the real person? Is that not? Well, I can't be the real person because why would the camera have been there at this particular moment? But it never tells you that. You have to figure it out.
Well, I will say that just to defend the movie though a little bit, the movie does at least have text on the screen that says original audio or whatever. Maybe it wasn't clear enough. And I also want to point out that, and because some documentaries don't do that, and you do have to, and there was controversy
be talking about that in a minute. Yeah,
sure. And there was controversy about the Anthony Bourdain film Roadrunner for similar reasons. I also want to point out that Errol Morris is an executive producer on this film.
Yes, he is.
I don't think that's a coincidence.
So he's creating his own genre. Part of the difficulty is the fact that it tries to present this Rashomon sort of approach to things, but the way these roll out, it's as though they have to have a gotcha moment for the audience. So rather than present these different perspectives up front, it's sort of like they go down one path. It's almost like a trial. So you hear the plaintiff side and then you switch and hear the defendant side rather than interweave those, which I think is more effective. I like the second approach better. The other thing here that you haven't really talked about is the fact that here's this guy whose parents are both veterans. So they were both, his mom and dad were in the military, you know, now retired. And then they find themselves in this weird situation of defending this son who's been accused of possible terrorism or links to terrorism and so forth. And it's their love for the son that eventually plays out even at the very end where some other information is revealed that I found to be one of the most fascinating aspects of this whole film. I mean, they're ready to emigrate with him to Canada just because he's their little boy who's been wrongfully accused and so forth. So I liked that dynamic in the film. And I think that's one of the things that made it intriguing from my perspective.
Yeah. And I don't want to be too negative here. You know, the fact is that I found Enemies of the State fascinating, a fascinating view. It's just that it confused me all the way through. And one of the things I wanted to point out that I liked is the fact that the film was able to get both sides, both the government side and the side of the people, and let them all have their say. And so consequently, that was good. Much of it is confusing, but at least it's unlike other documentaries like one we reviewed, Not Going Quietly, in which it was all one way, all one side, no dissenting views. So I can't be completely negative about Enemies of the State. I think there's a lot to enjoy, but it is a confusing watch.
Well, and I want to bring up the parents part of the equation here, Matt DeHart's parents, because near the end of the film, we get the sense that they have descended into full-on paranoia. The dad in particular comes to believe, I mean, he's like Gene Hackman in the Conversation. He comes to believe that the government is constantly surveilling him, constantly listening to him. I mean, he goes to this high-powered attorney's office and he's telling the attorney, you see the way that the pane of glass is moving in the window? That's because they have, and he, you know, goes off on this tangent about all the different technologies they have. And at first you start to think, well, they've been off the deep end this whole time. And so maybe they're buying into a narrative that doesn't exist. And yet the movie kind of makes you just as suspicious as they are, because
I mean, yeah,
of course it is. There are so many, we know so much about, I mean, not just with cases like this, but think about, you know, all of the leaks about the NSA that Edward Snowden was involved in. We know that the government has spied on people in these ways. So it's not, they're not too far afield from things that have happened before. And so by the end of the movie, you are, and I think this is the most effective thing it does, is by the end of the movie, you're starting to wonder, do I want to be on the side of the guy who has done genuinely problematic things, or am I on the side of the CIA who has spied on people?
Yeah, genuinely problematic things.
Exactly. Whose side can you be on? And the answer is, well, no one's really. And that makes it intriguing at the end, I think.
Yeah, I agree. And that was the documentary Enemies of the State. This is Movies 101, and it's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcasts of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to check out Misha and the Wolves and to take a retrospective look at the 2008 Rolling Stones concert film, Shine a Light. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
These thanks were handmade with organic free-range gratitude and artisan appreciation containing absolutely no artificial sarcasm, but were processed in a facility that also produces irony. Our sincere thanks to the members, grantors, underwriters, and volunteers from the staff and board of SPR and the entire public radio ecosystem.
And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbender, and I discussed the documentary Enemies of the State. Let's now move to two more documentaries, Misha and the Wolves and Martin Scorsese's 2008 Rolling Stones concert film, Shine a Light. Let's begin with a story that was based on a lie so fantastic, it's a wonder anybody believed it in the first place. That story is told in the documentary Misha and the Wolves, a film directed by San Hopkinson that explores the controversial story of the Belgian-born woman Misha de Fonseca, whose 1997 book, Misha, A Memoir of the Holocaust Years, became an international bestseller. Key among the book's passages, which purport to tell the tale of young Misha's trek across World War II-torn Europe in search of her parents, was her claim of having communed with a wolf pack. Soon, however, the questions came, especially after De Fonseca got into a legal squabble with her American publisher. Director Hopkinson sets the scene as it unfolded before tearing everything down by interviewing a range of those involved, with the exception of De Fonseca herself, whom Hopkinson portrays through the use of an actress and recreated scenes. Thus, the film itself, for all its qualities, of which there are many, plays fast and loose with how it attempts to arrive at a kind of truth. It does, though, achieve some sense of that truth, unlike De Fonseca, who, after being outed as a fraud, thought that she should be excused because she had come to genuinely believe her own lies.
Gee, hard to talk about this film without maybe revealing some aspects of it that at least took us by surprise, although they should not have in retrospect. But this was a stranger than fiction tale from the beginning. So Misha and the Wolves, I mean, the whole story just seemed like bullshit. And I think that, you know, so sometimes you just have to use the good brain that God gave you, as my fourth grade teacher used to say, because this did not make any sense from Jump Street, but she told her story so compellingly, and there was enough authenticity associated with the story that you wanted to believe the underlying event, which was the fact that she hiked 1500 miles through the German forest and developed this wolf pack family or whatever. And that was just so incredible. But people were, it was this story about a young girl in the Holocaust who had been separated from her parents. And so it's hard to take that on in any way. I mean, so even if people were disbelieving, nobody cross-examined her on this story very thoroughly because they wanted to believe it, because they wanted to have some optimistic hope about that whole horrible, horrific, tragic experience. But it's intriguing because we discover at one point, so she's going on all these talk shows and, you know, she's promoting her book and she's telling about her story and so forth. But then she refuses to go on Oprah, which of course would have been the big moneymaker. And that's what made her publisher really disconcerted, because it was like, wait a minute, no one turns down Oprah. But we started to realize, oh, this woman knows that if she goes on Oprah with their researchers, with their team, that they're going to find out that this story, you know, has been fabricated. And so that's sort of an interesting piece of it. But we do see folks who get involved in this. I was particularly interested in the story of the researchers overseas who were, you know, they were doing a thankless task. It's not even clear that they got paid any money to do this genealogical research. And the good news, I suppose, if there's any good news associated with the Nazi regime, it kept excellent records. And so they were able to access some of these original documents and sort of piece together what Misha's actual experience was or might have been. I think this is a documentary that's well worth watching on many different levels because of the contrasting characters. And you know what they say about docs, if you can find an interesting character who truly is a character to be the showpiece of your documentary, it's bound to have some success. And they certainly managed to find that in Misha and some of the other folks here.
Yeah, I mean, this is basically a page turner in documentary form. I mean, you want to know what the next twist is going to be. And there are plenty of twists in this story. And I liked a lot of the supporting players here, including the woman who survived the Holocaust and became a genealogist and kind of cracks this story wide open in a lot of ways. She's the one that, she's this little old lady riding the bus to the records facilities and sifting through hundreds of thousands of pages of documents. And then you also have this indie book publisher who, for a while, you're on her side, and then you're not on her side. And then you start to wonder, is she the villain of this piece in a strange way? You never really quite come to terms with that. If I did have a problem with Misha and the Wolves, it's that it is those recreations, which I don't even, maybe we shouldn't have even said that because it's almost a reveal within the movie. Although I could see it coming from a mile away and I resented the movie for thinking that I wouldn't know. But then I talked to you guys and you guys didn't even catch that that twist was in there in the first place. So I don't know.
So that shows you how clueless we are.
It was confusing. I kept thinking, wow, she looks one way in one scene and then another way in another. And then it was after it was over, we went, that was fabricated. How did we miss that?
I mean, I think the movie even tells you it was fabricated. So I don't know how you missed it.
So I guess we weren't paying attention. And I think that it is also from a legal perspective. I mean, it shows you how everyone gets embroiled in this sort of lawsuit ultimately. And the independent publisher, I mean, basically goes broke, you know, as a practical matter, as a result of having been sued, and then the tables turn and so forth. So I don't know. I think this is well worth watching for a variety of reasons. So Misha and the Wolves, available, I think, now streaming. And it also has some nice animated sequences and so forth that I think it gives it visual appeal as well.
Yeah. And that was Misha and the Wolves. Let's close with the Rolling Stones documentary, Shine a Light. Drummer Charlie Watts was the last original member to join the Rolling Stones. The others, Mick Jagger and Keith Richards among them, wanted Watts so badly that they claimed they shoplifted to raise money enough to ensure he got paid. Whatever the truth of that, Watts, working closely with bassist Bill Wyman for three decades, was the band's timekeeper. And every song from Paint It Black to Sympathy for the Devil shows off his handiwork. The three of us are longtime Stones fans. I actually own the bragging rights of having seen them in concert way back in 1966. And we thought the best way to honor Watts's passing was to re-see and then review Martin Scorsese's 2008 Stones concert film, Shine a Light. Charlie Watts was never one to claim the concert spotlight, but he was an essential cog in what has proved to be one of, if not the greatest rock groups ever to take the stage.
It was really good to revisit this because I had not seen it since it played in theaters. I saw it in the theater and it wasn't a very packed screening, but I do remember there was an older couple there who actually applauded after all the songs. And I remember thinking, they can't hear you, you know, like Mick Jagger doesn't know that you're applauding.
And it was not me and Dan.
Yeah, it wasn't us, yeah.
No, I knew you then and it was not you. But I was thinking the whole time because, I mean, obviously the performance is great. Martin Scorsese knows how to make an electric concert film. The whole time I was just thinking about it in contrast to the other concert films that either Scorsese or the Stones have participated in. Compare this to something like Gimme Shelter, which has a cloud of doom hanging over it the whole time and a cloud
waltz
of murder. And then compared to The Last Waltz, which is this elegiac stoned farewell sort of movie. And this is the opposite of all of that. And I also love the fact that it employs archival footage of the Stones when they first started, saying, you know, like, oh, I think I probably got like two more years in me, you know, like 24-year-old Mick Jagger thinking he'll be
50 years
he'll
later.
Be done. Yeah. So it was great to see this. Charlie Watts, maybe the most influential rock and roll drummer there was, at least in the mainstream rock scene. And
well, he certainly had a career longer than Ginger Baker. So I guess we can, you know,
or John
very
Bonham.
True. Very true. So it was really good to see this again. It's such a fun movie.
I think part of the problem for me was, though, I mean, it's this concert for the Clinton Foundation. So unlike being a large scope venue, it's like in a smaller theater with a bunch of people who've been specifically invited or have paid like the ticket price to get in. So it's not like kind of the usual rock crowd, for better or for worse. And so in some respects, I didn't like that particular choice, but I think it serves well because we could see Martin Scorsese and Mick Jagger talking about what's the playlist going to look like and so forth. And they were mixing it up. And so
that felt like Spinal Tap.
Yeah. Right, right.
Yeah. So fun. Yeah.
Some of their iconic performances, albeit 50 years later, because of the way that it played out and so forth. So definitely worth watching. And Charlie Watts has always been the odd one out in many respects. When they were all wearing these like dramatic costumes, he was wearing these like tailored suits with fedoras. And so I've always gotten a kick out of him, not only as a musician in terms of his talent, but as a person, you know, living this life during the 60s, but taking his own path.
Yeah, it's strange when you think that everyone thought that after Brian Jones died, that Keith Richards was the next one to go, and he'll outlive us all. Well, we were just talking about Shine a Light, the 2008 Martin Scorsese concert film about the Rolling Stones. This is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster. And early in the show, Nathan Weinbinder, Murray Patruthart, and I discussed Enemies of the State and Misha and the Wolves. Let's take this moment to thank Peter Glarbert for both producing and engineering the show. And we thank you to our loyal listeners. We invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, when we'll again check out all the best that cinema has to offer, wherever we can find it. Until then, remember these words from the late writer Edward Abbey: better a cruel truth than a comfortable delusion. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.